It is Saturday, December 15th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KUSP Public Radio. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News and Make a Robot at Home, a discussion with author and maker Michael Morales. That's here on Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridges the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, we're not taking phone calls. No, we're going to be talking about a book, Make an Adreno-Controlled Robot in the Second Half with Michael Morales. And we also have in the house a geek of his own right. We'll talk about Legos and creativity. This break, this winter break, spend some time with your family being geeky. That's what we're suggesting. We have some suggestions for you today on Geek Speak. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Wyatt Troxell, my son, 11-year-old, who wants to share the books he's currently reading. Legos, anyone? That's what we're going to be talking about a bit. We also have Michael Morales coming on. He's from London. We are getting him tied in. Ah, there he is, flashing away. Good, good, good. Let's pull him in then, shall we? Michael, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
I really appreciate you making the long-distance journey to us virtually to talk about, well, being excited about creativity as games. I think it's a bit of our theme today. We're going to talk first off, you want to talk a little bit about Arduino. It's a big basis for your book, and I'd like you to go ahead and introduce what Arduino is. I've talked about it before on the show, but please do.
Sure. I've been living in the Arduino world for the last few years. Arduino is a microcontroller system. It's a small microcontroller, which is designed to bring computer capabilities to people who are not either computer scientist or electrical engineers. It was originally developed about 5 years ago for to provide a computer resource to artists and designers. And it consists of the microcontroller and a board, in fact, a whole family of boards, which we'll talk a little bit more about later on. It also consists of a software development environment, which is designed for non-programmers. The development environment originated from MIT, and it was built in a way so that it was very easy for people that weren't programmers to get going. But perhaps the most significant aspect of Arduino is the community, the ecosystem around it. Arduino is open source hardware and software. You can download the software for free. The designs of the hardware are published, and if you want to build your own, you can. And people are encouraged to design their own variations, of which there are hundreds of different boards suitable for different purposes.
And you're going to tell me about a new one. You're going to tell me about a new board in just a second. I just want to give everybody an idea that, like, physically, what this looks like. It looks like a little electronics board that, you know, doesn't have a case. So it's just a bare board. It's got solder on the back. It's got components on the front, and it has. Normally, they have a USB port on them. You plug in a USB cable to power them and to control them from your computer. And it's a rapid prototyping environment. Well, it's similar to rapid prototyping spaces, and the thing that's happened now because of these things, they're under $50. They're pretty cheap. You have a complete computer microcontrolling environment that you can program simply. So it takes that. It used to be that if you wanted to program your own microcontroller and, like, make your own robot or make your own door sensing device or a whole bunch of things you can do with this thing, right? You'd have to kind of invest in a multi-$1,000 kit. And so the only people that were doing this kind of stuff were working at companies doing it, or were extreme hobbyists. So now it kind of comes into that space where I recommend that you could pick up Michael's book, Make an Adreno-Controlled Robot, and some components, and after about a week of playing with your kids and such, you'd have a robot driving around the house that you made it completely. So it's a really different space. It's kind of exciting. So tell us about this newest Arduino board. What's different about it?
The typical Arduino boards consist of various sizes of boards. Some are small, so they can be put into small objects or lightweight objects for aircraft and so on, and radio control aircraft. Or some are larger for driving big interactive installations and so on. But a typical board has the microcontroller and lots of connections to which you can plug in hundreds of different kinds of sensors and actuators that can be used with it. The new board is interesting. It's the first of the official Arduino boards that contains not just the microcontroller, but a whole broad range of sensors and actuators on the board itself. So it's got a joystick, it's got a potentiometer, switches, it's got an accelerometer to detect movement and position, temperature sensors, light sensors,
a whole bunch of buttons,
LEDs. And what makes it different is that it makes Arduino accessible to people that have no interest in the wiring together or the acquisition of different parts to connect things up and build a breadboard. And I have to say, from my perspective, building a breadboard can be a lot of fun, but there are some people that prefer to have everything in one place and not having to wire things together. So it's really the first board that actually does all kinds of interesting stuff right out of the box.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's definitely a stumbling block on playing with Arduino, is that you know, some of the stuff recommends soldering, but even if you don't go to the soldering, the breadboarding is trying to figure out how that board works. You're plugging in little wires, you're connecting little sensors, they have polarity, so you have to get the direction right. I mean, there's a lot to do just to get the first basis. One of those reasons why I kind of recommend having a book that guides you a bit, though there's some great little demos as well. So this board really is, you can start using it right away. You can buy it like kind of as a game controller, just that you would plug in your computer and start playing a game. And then coincidentally, it's got all these other features you could start playing with. So as you get comfortable with it, you know, it's very similar to a project that Wyatt and I actually participated called Makey Makey, I think was the name of it. Are you familiar with that project?
I have heard of it, yes.
Yeah, and it was an Arduino-based board that had sensors and actually has a whole bunch of, instead of having buttons on it, they were actually using capacitive touch, I believe. So you would actually kind of touch the sensor and it would work.
The warmth of your finger would touch it and it would feel it, sense it, and then put it into the computer.
So it was that your finger was like a button. And we did some fun things like alligator clip to it and do a circle so you could play a game, like a jumping kind of game, where you're actually just touching your hands to somebody else, right? So that was kind of the interface of the game. And Wyatt, you were playing, we did a review last time on GeekSpeak, you actually did a review of that and game development in general. So let's go on. So this new one is called Arduino Explora, which is cool, kind of like exploring.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Another exotic Arduino name.
Yes, definitely. And I think all of them are a little exotic. And the thing that's really great about this is that you do download a free software package on your computer. It works on Windows and Mac and Linux. And right off the bat with a USB cable and that, you can start programming this board. And the application, the IDE is what we normally call it, comes with a whole bunch of samples right off the bat. So it's really easy to step into hardware development now because of Arduino in a lot of sense. Let's go on to other hardware development. Wyatt, you've got a few books in front of you. Can you tell me a bit about what you got?
Yes. Our first book, all of these are Lego books. The first is The Unofficial Lego Technic Builder's Guide by, I don't know how to pronounce this, but...
Let me ask you, what's Lego Technic? What's the difference between Lego Technic and normal block Legos?
Well, Lego is just blocks made of certain cubes, but... Now they've got Technic, which is like screws and knobs and
gears
that you can make like a catapult out of Legos. But they're really expensive because they've got like
they're different. Good. Yeah. The traditional Legos we know of are blocks. Everything they recognize is this traditional Lego block. But the Technic series is kind of more advanced, and we're seeing that in kits all the time. You've got tons of kits like that. Most of the Star Wars kits, I think you have some Technic in them, and they're used for structural reinforcement as well as gears and things of that nature. We're talking about those long black rods that kind of slide through a Lego block. That whole thing is called a Technic. A Technic? Is that Michael? Is that the right term? Do you know Technic?
It is Technic.
Yeah, Technic. So that book is the unofficial Lego Technic building. And it basically tells you what all of them are called, describes what they do, what you can use them for, and a little bit of building suggestions. It's pretty cool. I've got one in front of me called The Unofficial Lego Builder's Guide, second edition. And this one's the more traditional blocks. It's by Alan Bedford. All three of these books are actually from No Starch Press. And Wyatt, it seems like when we get these books, normally they go into your collection and you start reading them. Fervently. The Unofficial Lego Builder's Guide, a second edition, it really talks about every single block you could have, what's the strength, how building techniques in like making sure to overlap your blocks for strength and also for color design. It's just a wonderful guide. I think that anyone that has a collection of Legos would love this book. And the last book?
Yes,
what?
The last book is the Lego Adventure Book. What it is it's pretty much a book about history, about the Legos. It's what has been made by people at the Lego company. It's got like things that are built that are in real life but turned into Legos.
Okay, and it's kind of a instruction guide for a few things you can build. So it's kind of like a a collection of manuals, if you will, for some complicated cityscapes and towns and things of that nature.
Yeah.
Yeah. So all these books, there's links to them from geekspeak.org if you want to know more about them. And thank you, Wyatt, for coming in and talking. Please feel free to speak about Arduino and programming and stuff as we continue to talk about that. And I think, Michael, do you have anything that could lead us from Legos to into Arduinos by chance?
Sure. Wyatt, I don't know whether you've come across a book which has just been published called Make Lego and Arduino Projects.
He might run across that around the December 25th time frame.
I read that.
Oh, you've seen it?
I've seen a little bit. I've done a little bit of it.
Okay, so tell us about it.
Yeah, what did you think of it, Wyatt?
Oh, it was pretty good.
What I found interesting about the book is that it uses the Technic components and, in fact, illustrates in detail how to put the Technic components together, but actuates them through Arduino. And the benefit of that is that all of the hundreds and hundreds of Arduino hardware and software add-ons that are available for download from the web can be used in the Lego project. One of the strengths of Arduino, and I think one of the reasons why it's become so popular, is that there are literally hundreds and hundreds of free software components to connect virtually anything you can think of, any kind of sensor or actuator you can think of. There is at least one library for connecting to Arduino, and what the Make Lego and Arduino Projects does is it takes that the flexibility and capability of Arduino and connects it into the Lego construction capability.
And you know that Legos had a robotic kind of system for a while called Mindstorms. We use that sometimes. We have a kit like that at the university that I work at, and it has its own programming language and its own microcontroller, if you will. And Wyatt, you've played with that a bit, right?
Yeah. I actually went to, they have like this place in a town.
Oh, the art center in Ben Lomond.
Yeah, the art center.
You did classes
in
robotics.
You get to play with them, and I played with them there. You can make like, you go online, you find how to build it.
Mm-hmm.
You build it, and it's got like a sensor.
Yeah, so you had a little robot that was driving around, or was it an arm? What kind of robot did you make?
It was a robot that could, there's two different types of, there was a red
sensor.
Uh-huh. A red ball and a blue ball. And when it saw the blue ball, it would hit it.
Cool.
With like its arm, it would just hit it and it'd go to flying.
And it wouldn't hit the red ball?
But it wouldn't hit the red ball. It would just back away from the red ball.
Cool. So those are a couple sensors, probably color sensors of some sort. Now, Michael, this isn't your book. It's from the same company, from O'Reilly, and Make Lego and Arduino Projects. And I agree, the one thing I didn't like about Mindstorms is the closed source aspect of it. I believe that you had to do software development on a Windows box, and I'm not sure if that's still the case. But if you step away from that place and you go into an open source space like Arduino, now all of a sudden the simplicity of building with Legos and especially Technic systems, and then the wonderful open source libraries and collective engagement you can see in the online community around Arduino, the merge of those sounds awesome. I think that this book is going to have to come to our collection pretty quick. So thank you for the recommendation, Michael.
Sure.
You know, I'm going to step you in. You also suggested some video games since we were going in this whole help get your kids be creative and engineering and that kind of theme for today's show in this holiday season is perfect for Geek Speak. You recommended an article about video games. Can you tell me a little bit?
Indeed. I came across an article in Wired, which I highly recommend. It's in the Wired Game Life series, www.wired.com.
I actually put it on geekspeak.org, so if you people go up today, they can see the show already, December 15th show, 2012.
And what appealed to me about that is that it's a collection of really cool games which are designed, they're intended for kids, but they are all about construction and creativity. Some of which are kind of classics like Minecraft. Some of them I hadn't come across before. There's one called Amazing Alex, which looks really interesting. It comes from the Rovio people, the Angry Birds people. But instead of kind of destroying things with the birds, it's an environment where you create these extraordinary machines from household objects. Kind of a do-it-yourself Rube Goldberg, which looks like it would be really, really
fun. Exactly, I describe it. Building up Rube Goldberg devices. So you have an object, you have to use it somehow, and as you have it, you know, like get a pair of scissors, you have a balloon, and you have a pail, and as you start putting these things on screen, you can basically make a giant, crazy machine. Really, really cool. And I love that it's got, it does have, of course, it has Minecraft, which we covered a lot on this show. Another one that I really like is World of Goo.
Oh, yeah, that one's a good one. I actually have that one at my house.
Yeah.
I don't play it that much because, well, the levels get harder and harder as you go along. But it's like creating a pathway of weird, icky, gooey stuff that travels around with lines. You have to try and get it to, like, a tube or something.
Yeah, and the thing that's interesting, of course, is that it has a physics engine, which is as accurate as you can do. So you really have this idea that as you're understanding how to build in this game, you're actually kind of understanding how physics works. I mean, in the sense that it's like playing with Legos or with Tinker Toys or that kind of thing. It's just on screen. And, of course, level after level after level, you have to think of more complicated ways of shapes you can make to get past your next point. I also love the first one in the article, Kerbal, which is just a flight simulator, but it's an accurate space flight simulator, right? So you have to understand that you have to turn your ship around to slow down, right? It's pretty cool.
Accurate, and I think relatively easy to use. So Wyatt, what's your favorite game in this kind of construction arena?
Well, I like Minecraft a lot. I play it all the time. And the main reason at first was just to create a building, just create something that you like of only a couple of blocks. And then now it's like thousands of blocks, and you can do like survival, which you have to survive through the night. There's like zombies and skeletons and new things like an Enderman that can teleport.
Or and
a creeper that can blow up. It's cool.
Yeah, and I think that's really interesting. My 6-year-olds play, or 7-year-olds, well, they're changing ages, so my daughters play it as well. And thank you. And they are get in there and do a creative mode and pretty quickly build something. River recently, she played for about 15 minutes. I came back and she had this wonderful house that she'd made, and the floor was a you know, checker floor pattern with glass and gold, so you could see through it, but it also was kind of shiny, and the walls were all done, and she was, you know, she gets into that creative space, very much like Legos. It's just a 3D world, computer world.
It's like Legos, but with no limitation in terms of what you can actually do.
Well, you can have
unlimited quality of Legos.
No, but you can have like texture packs. There is a Lego texture pack, which makes it Lego. So then you could like build something in Minecraft, copy that, and then turn it into a book, and then actually build it in front of your in your own home.
Pretty fantastic. Well, let's go ahead and start talking about your book, Michael. Your book is Make an Arduino-Controlled Robot, Autonomous and Remote-Controlled Bots on Wheels. Why is a robot such a compelling thing to make?
Well, it's compelling for a number of reasons. I actually started building robots because I was looking for a way of demonstrating lots of different techniques to illustrate my previous book, which is the Arduino Cookbook. And it's just a great way of using lots of different capabilities. But what separates robots from almost all the other projects that I and most other people build with Arduino is that you end up with something which has a characteristic and behaviors almost which mimic live creatures, which can be endlessly modified and expanded. So it's a never-ending but thoroughly enjoyable challenge, which is accessible to anybody.
Sounds pretty good. There's something really compelling about seeing something that decides for itself what to do.
Not only seeing it decide for itself, but knowing that you have the capability of influencing and teaching it to make its decision ever more complex.
Cool.
That's part of that creativity, that ability to almost emulate the spark of life, I think is one of the driving forces that is in all programmers, that gives the activity of programming its enjoyment. And creating a physical manifestation of that in an object which can move around, explore its environment, and makes decisions is a great challenge and something that's thoroughly enjoyable.
What?
I saw this robot in a magazine which actually has a mind of its own, which you tell it to do something, and it goes and do it. Like, if you want, like, a water bottle, I'll go and get a water bottle and come back with one.
Do you do that verbally? Do you, like, say, hey,
no,
I'd like a water bottle?
You don't say it. You actually have to, like, type in on a keyboard, and, like, plug it into the machine for it knows where it's going to get.
Yeah, so there is this idea that robots, you know, as we grew up with them in fiction space, Michael, were these things that were going to make our lives easier and do tasks for us with a level of simplicity that would emulate a human being completely, the android type space where you have a bipedal humanoid kind of creature that can do your bidding for you. That's been a fantasy for a long time, and we've, of course, seen lots of storylines around that idea. Why? I think one of the things of benefit when you're building a robot is you realize how complex we actually are as you start building.
Absolutely. In fact, the term robot originated from a play from the, I think it's the Polish word for work. And the fiction that you referred to, I think split evenly, at least the stuff that I read, between that which helped humanity and that which challenged or wanted to exterminate it.
Sure.
The kind of robots that we're working with today, I think are a lot simpler than the stuff of Isaac Asimov.
Sure.
But they're nonetheless very interesting. I mean, one of the remarkable things about building your own robot is realizing how simple it can be to give a robot what apparently looks like very sophisticated behavior. Sensors in robots can be aware of the environment and can navigate through it, avoid obstacles, respond to things with relatively simple programming. And one of the things that I tried to do in the book was to focus on the simplest possible solutions for a half a dozen or so of the most common and interesting tasks to show that things like building robots which can effectively follow lines or avoid obstacles actually can be programmed with very, very simple and easy to understand code.
And we're going to get into that code and the structure of these robots and more about Michael's book in just a second. But first, I want to let you know that in the air with me is Wyatt Troxell, my son. I'm Lyle Troxell. You're listening to 88.9 KUSP at KUSP.org. You can follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook. Everything we talk about today on GeekSpeak, we put up on our website, GeekSpeak.org. It's a convenient way to find out what we've been talking about, find the links and such, and go, what were they saying about robots and doing, huh? You can go there, geekspeak.org, and learn all about that. Our guest, Michael Morales, is a maker with a wonderful book called Make an Arduino-Controlled Robot, Autonomous and Remote-Controlled Bots on Wheels. And we're talking about that book right now, which is available from O'Reilly. I recommend this holiday season, if you're going to spend some time with your family, do so with some in a geeky way. Get some gear together, get the book together, and build a robot. It's a lot of fun. We're going to talk a bit more about what it's like, how you do it, and all that in the second half of the show. If you want to ask us questions throughout the week, we're not taking calls today, but if you'd like to ask us questions throughout the week, we do respond to the email geeks@geekspeak.org, and that's geeks@geekspeak.org, and of course, go to our website to find out more about that. And of course, we're on Twitter and Facebook and all that jazz as well. All right, Michael, tell us more. The bots that you suggest in your book are two different types, a two-wheeled and a four-wheeled.
Yeah, they have different capabilities. I mean, there are a lot of different kinds of robot you can build. I mean, you can build a robot that can crawl or walk or slither or even fly. But the wheeled robots, the two- and four-wheeled robots, are the most popular, and they're probably also the most flexible. A two-wheeled robot basically uses a caster. So it has two wheels to drive the robot and a caster to balance it.
Just a rolling ball on one side, yeah.
Yeah. Is that it's light, maneuverable. It's particularly good for tasks like following a line because it can turn on a dime, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it does require a smooth surface because the caster is typically a ball and doesn't run very well outdoors. So
you can kind of think of this. I'm going to get everybody's the mind right. You can think of this as a three-wheeled vehicle, just that one of the wheels is just a ball that can go any direction. So it's really a two-wheel vehicle with a balance point, and that normally drags behind it. Yeah, that last thing just kind of bounces behind.
And
so you can kind of go on carpet with it. You can definitely go on linoleum, but not so much on the outside and concrete and such.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, so what do you mean it's good at following a line? How do you, I mean, so can I build a robot, draw a line on the ground, and actually will, like, just by itself do that path?
Well, Typically, line-following robots use a sensor to determine where the robot is with respect to the line and then control the motor speeds in order to follow it. So both a two- and a four-wheeled robot, they can both do that. The benefit of the two-wheeled version is that because the wheels are driven independently, the robot can rotate in place, whereas the four-wheel a four-wheeled robot needs a slightly wider radius, so it can follow a line. It's just usually doesn't handle sharp turns as well.
Now, this book, I'm looking at the cover of the book. You've got the two-wheel robot in the cover of the book. This guy looks like a five AAA batteries in the front, and the caster's right below that. So actually, the front of the robot has the caster wheel, and it has sensors and such. Where's this? Where am I going to get, if I want to pick up this book, then where do I get all the components I need? I currently, of course, have an Arduino and such, but most people don't. Where do you get all this, the stuff to actually build it as well?
Well, there is a parts list in the book, and the components are standardized. So if you do want to build the robot, you can actually, in fact, if you go online to the O'Reilly site, there is a parts list on the O'Reilly site.
Which we're linking to from the show
page,
yeah.
If you want to get straight into building the robot and don't want to spend time acquiring all the different pieces, you can actually buy a complete kit from MakerShed.
Mm-hmm.
And MakerShed have both all of the components for the two-wheel drive or for the four-wheel drive. And you can buy everything you need to get that going except the batteries, but including the book at MakerShed.
Cool.
And, of course, you don't have to build a duplicate of the exact same robot that I built. The techniques that are described in the book can be used for a completely different robot. So if you want to use a different gear motor and so on, the book explains the techniques for driving that and covers a number of different alternatives for components.
So in chapter one, but it's in the second part of chapter one, or maybe chapter two, you're constructing the technique. The actual, okay, I don't know what chapter it is. I'm trying to flip through an ebook, but let me just say what I was interested in is the line following part. It looks like you're using three sensors. So you put three sensors about three fingers apart, kind of, and they look down in front of the robot. What kind of sensor is that? It's not a human eye that determines things. It's something much more simpler. What is it?
It's an infrared reflective sensor, and what that is it consists of two parts. It consists of kind of LED diode that emits an invisible light.
So it's a little light bulb in the center.
It's a little light bulb, and it also, next to it, is a device which is sensitive to infrared that produces a voltage as the level of infrared it detects changes.
So it's just a light sensor, a very simple light sensor.
It's an invisible light sensor.
Right.
And an invisible light emitter. And because of the way that they're oriented, these are facing down. And if the surface is reflecting light, then the detector will sense that. And so the robot can determine how much reflective material there is below each sensor. If the line is drawn, typically in line-following applications, the robot's running on a white, therefore a reflective surface, and the line is typically non-reflective black paint or even more common, just black electrical tape laid out as a line.
Because it's not so fun to paint your floor over and over again, right?
Indeed. In fact, three-quarter-inch black electrical tape makes a really convenient and removable and effective line.
And you need the tape anyway so you can build your stuff effectively. You always have to put lots of electrical tape on. I'm always kind of, I kind of boo-boo electrical tape, but for this purpose, it's perfect.
It is perfect.
So why three sensors aiming down? It seems like you could do this with two.
You can actually do it with two. The problem is that if the robot is moving relatively quickly over a line which veers sharply, the robot can lose contact with the line.
Mm-hmm.
So the more sensors that you have in the line, the more sensors that you have in a row above the line, the less likely the robot is going to miss the line.
Right.
So You can do it with two sensors. The robot would move slowly, and if the line curves are gentle, the robot will follow it. Three are used because is much, much less likely to miss the line. And
yeah.
Part of the fun of this, and indeed it is a common challenge. There are a number of schools that run contests with robots to find the robot that can follow a track, a line track, as quickly as possible. And the one that navigates the track in the fastest time is the winner.
It's the simplest way in some ways to say use sight to figure out where you are and go. And that's the reason why it's used, of course. I mean, you could just, if you wanted to make a dumb device that had a track that was locked in and had to go that way, couldn't have it do anything else, all you'd be doing with this is speed. But in this situation, that kind of robot challenges, it's speed, but also processing of the information around you. It's an interesting little feedback loop. So the general idea when the line changes that one of the sensors is going to see, the sensors are going to see a different level of reflection, a little bit different voltage level. And then, of course, the processor, that the application you've written says, if the right-hand side sees a dip in light, then advance the left wheel a little bit more so you'll turn to the right. Like it's that kind of loop, that kind of programming language you're writing. And it's relatively simple, you said. How do you mean, how simple is that program?
It's as simple as, first of all, in the Arduino language, there's a function called analog read, which reads the value of an analog signal, in this case, the signal coming from the sensor. And that will return a value which is proportional to the amount of light reflected. And by doing an analog read of each of the sensors, you can therefore get the value. And by doing some simple arithmetic, subtracting the values, you can work out the relative difference between the levels from each of the sensors. You can then use that difference to drive the motors at an appropriate speed so that it attempts to balance out the signal, to get the signal back so that it is as expected when the robot is over the line.
So you're saying it's almost like there isn't a conditional loop in here. There isn't a conditional in there. It's really much more like always drive the wheel based on the difference between these two sources.
Indeed.
It's pretty cool.
You can do it conditionally.
Yeah.
The robot would oscillate backwards and forwards, and that would certainly work, but it's much more elegant if you use a smooth variation of motor control so that the rate at which the robot corrects is proportional to the error with respect to the line.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so what are the four-wheel vehicle, the four-wheel robot?
The four-wheel and the two-wheel robots actually use identical code. So the logic to implement the various behaviors, and we've talked about one line folding. If we have time, we'll talk about some others later.
Mm-hmm.
The logic to implement those behaviors is identical. The difference between them is that the four-wheel drive actually uses four motor controllers, one to drive each of the motors. And mechanically, it's a little bit different,
mm-hmm.
but the actual programming is identical.
Okay. So in the four-wheel drive vehicle, you do have four drives, motors, right?
You have four motors, and
are you using motors or servos?
These are motors. So it's a small gear-driven motor driving the wheel.
Mm-hmm. And not a stepper motor?
It's not a stepper motor.
Yeah. So we've talked before about servos versus stepper motors versus motors. And stepper motors are just really much more complicated. You have to do a lot to do them. And the thing about the Arduino space, this maker space where we have processing power, you can actually get a board that drives stepper motors, and it makes it a lot easier. So it's almost this complexity that used to be this giant overwhelming step to do stepper motors. And you need stepper motors, basically. You need that kind of detail of movement when you're dealing maze finding, where you have a bot go through a maze, come back out, because you have to be really accurate. And there's other cases, of course, where you'll want them. In this situation, you're not suggesting stepper motors, which I think is good, because it's a bit of an impedance to get to the level where you understand them well enough to use them. And they're more expensive. How does the gear motor work, though? I mean, you just go a little slower, and therefore you kind of compensate for it, or what?
These robots are using a motor driver, which is called called an H-bridge. The name
sure.
comes from the
look of the circuit. Yeah,
the circuit of the motor is capable of connecting up the motor so that the positive and negative sides of the motor can be switched to the positive and negative sides of the batteries or reversed, which is controlling the direction of the motor. And the speed of the motor is controlled by switching the power on and off quickly. It's called pulse width modulation. Mm-hmm. And the Arduino has a command called analog write, where you give it a value which controls how much power the motor gives. And there's a board that is used which provides the power, because the Arduino microcontroller itself doesn't have the capability of powering a motor. So it needs help, semiconductor devices which are on this H-bridge device, which is actually providing the interface to the motor.
And to be clear, this is another component that you purchase. The board's already built for you. You build the components with it. You solder them. You can solder them in. You can also buy this thing already soldered. So your book definitely goes through like how to construct this thing from a kit, but you could also buy it, I think, pre-stocked.
That's right. And in fact, the book goes into detail on how to build one.
Yeah, you could build it from scratch. Sure.
But you can also, and the book suggests some alternatives, which are pre-soldered if you don't want to. You don't want to do the soldering.
And the power thing's really important, because of course one of the reasons why you'd want the Arduino to be a low power device, and there's actually really ultra low power versions of Arduino, is that you're going to want this thing to work off of batteries. And even, you know, of course, the robot, you're going to want to work off batteries. And the least amount of power you can use, the longer your batteries last. And of course, the motors themselves just are going to take power. So the processing system is low power. By the way, all this stuff we're talking about when we're talking about power, this is all safe. Like, you can't hurt yourself on this. There's nothing, no electricity in this book, except for maybe burning yourself with a soldering iron, that you can actually hurt yourself in. I think a lot of people are concerned about electricity, but I assure you, if you've got two batteries and you don't hear anything clicking, well, there's sometimes you can make high voltage, but in this situation, you wouldn't have high voltage. You're more likely to damage the components with being careless than yourself. So it's a pretty safe thing to do. Let's mm-hmm. let's talk about, so you've got this controller that you send signals to, and the way it knows where it is it's given the motor, it's given each motor's 15 pulses of go, then it knows that it's at least 15 pulses forward. So you kind of keep track of how much you give it. It doesn't necessarily know how far it's gone, but it doesn't need to. It just needs to know comparatively how much it's turned and such of that nature. Is that right?
Yes, for many of the tasks, for example, the line following task, which we talked about, and some of the other tasks like edge detection and so on, it doesn't really need to know how far it's gone. It only needs to know how it's oriented with respect to its environment. We've talked about the line following. In edge sensing, the task is about moving the robot around, but avoiding falling off the edge of a surface. So if the robot's running on a table, detecting when it gets to the edge of the table. Typically, when experimenting with this task, you can actually lay out a virtual edge by using that same black electrical tape, mm-hmm. and the robot will detect when it gets to the point where the tape is indicating it's the end of its world.
And in this, the components you're using, the suggested components you're using, it actually has, there's the front of the robot in the two wheel, and I think three wheel, there's like a bar where you can put the sensors on. You can kind of slide it back and forth. So you've got some space there. And so the edge detection one is really taking those same infrared sensors. That's a little light emitting diode that, you know, shines a light down, and then another sensor that determines if the light's bouncing back. So when you're on a bright surface, it bounces back. When you've got something underneath it, it's dark. And so on an edge detection, which was very convenient when you actually are ready to, you know it works, you can put it on top of a table. And one of those sensors goes off the edge of the table, it's not going to get the reflection back, and it knows it has to turn. And basically, you can have a robot relatively easily move around the table. And if you put like a big piece of black paper in front of it, it'll stop and turn around and orient itself and figure out how to move from there. I want to talk, so those are the IR sensors. The sensing stuff is the really interesting part to me. There are just a myriad of sensors. They come out, new ones come out all the time. We're speaking with Michael Margolis. His book is Make an Arduino-Controlled Robot, Autonomous and Remote-Controlled Bots on Wheels from O'Reilly. And we're chatting with him about the possibility of just grabbing a book like this, getting some investment, I think $100, less than $100 worth of parts, and you're going to be building little robots you can program and change and figure out how things work. It's a great way to understand programming, and it's a great way to understand electronics. I highly recommend it. Can you tell me about distance detection? Like, sometimes I've seen robots that will come up to a surface and stop before it and then turn. What's going on there?
Indeed. And what you can add to the robot is a sensor which will detect how far an object is from the robot. There are number of technologies for doing that. One of the most common is sonar, basically a device which sends out an ultrasonic pulse and monitors to see how long it takes for that pulse to return. And because we know the speed of sound, we can work out how far the object is.
And so this is the technology we've stolen from bats, right?
Indeed.
Okay.
Indeed. And another technique for detecting distance is using infrared. It's a little bit different approach than the reflectance sensors that we talked about. It's the infrared technology that's used in range-finding cameras.
How does that work? Is it detecting the duration it took to get the light back?
That would be tricky.
Yeah.
It's measuring the parallax change of the reflection.
Oh, okay. So therefore it has to have two different sources and two different detectors, is that right?
It uses one source
okay.
and is working out the angle of the reflection from the source.
Okay, so if you have two objects looking kind of forward and the sensor can kind of pick up a range of space and they're slight, are they angled or are they going directly ahead of each other?
Well, the angle is very narrow.
Okay.
So the change in parallax is actually very, very small, but it's enough so that the sensor is capable of detecting objects from about 4 or 5 inches out to a few meters.
Interesting.
Some of them can detect more. I mean, my preference is the ultrasonic. It has slightly greater range. It's
yeah.
a slightly more expensive solution, but it is capable of more range.
Yeah.
But
now,
going back to the
way the infrared distance sensor works is just like how we sense distance with our eyes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So we have two eyes. We're looking at an object. You really don't know distance unless you're you have kind of a dual perspective from it. I don't have parallax in my eyes, right? So I only actually look through one eye at a time. It's a birth defect. And when an object is thrown to me, anyone can do this. If you close one eye and you try to catch an object, it's actually quite hard. I'm very skilled at it because I've done it for years. So if you throw to me a golf ball that's the wrong size, I can't catch it. But because I know the size of an object, it's relatively easy for me to determine where it is. And so we also use
size. And the likely speed and when it's thrown, you can compensate for it.
We have amazing abilities in that case in doing that kind of thing. So the sonar you like better, that idea that you're gonna bounce a high frequency off, it's going to only reflect back when it hits something. And it knows, it has some kind of pattern in its bounce. So it knows, or it goes ping, and when it hears that ping back, it knows because the distance, the time it took to travel that sound. And so anything in front of it will cause a reflection, right? Like a pencil or a hair. I mean, how granular is it?
It really depends on the sensor, and in fact, there are a number of different sensors, and some of them are graded in terms of the width that it can, the width of the object that it can sense, and also the distance that it can sense. But the typical sensors that are used by hobbyists would need an object to be a few inches wide. A pencil probably wouldn't be detected.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's really interesting. I want to chat, Michael. I work at the University of California, Santa Cruz, the Digital Arts New Media Program, and we do a lot of Arduino stuff and a lot of installation art. And this kind of the same kind of stuff is used in our space to engage with an audience member, right? So you don't have a robot, you've got a video piece. And as a person walks close to the video piece, it knows how close you are and it starts playing a bit. If you walk back, it plays a different bit. So just the idea of being able to sense the environment and interact with an audience in a different way, that's where I see this kind of stuff a lot. I love putting it on something that moves around, of course. Do you think of this as more, do you think of autonomous robots as more than a toy?
Is it more than a toy? If the definition of a toy is an object that's fun, then it's a toy.
Then everything's a toy. I mean, I've had a lot of fun with a pencil.
A toy.
Yeah, sure.
Indeed. It's a great way to actually learn about a whole broad range of technologies that relate to physical computing. And the thing about the choice of a robot as a project, as opposed to the choice of all the other interesting things that you can do with Arduino, is that because of the broad range of capabilities, the expandability of the robot, and the fact that there are behaviors that are mimicking things in real life, it has a compelling aspect to it, which other projects, however much fun, don't seem to have. For example, we were talking about distance detection. Mm-hmm. One of the things that you can do is if you mount the distance sensor on a servo, on a controllable motor, on a motor...
A rotating platform on top of, kind of like a head.
Kind of like a head, exactly. You can get the robot to scan. And with the robot turning its head, looking around, you begin to give it the capability to explore the environment much the way a person would.
Or a cat. Because it feels indeed much more like a cat looking around and deciding which way to go. So have you built, in this kit, in this book, you talk about this, the cover of the book has this robot that's looks like eyes. That's the thing that's cool about the ultrasonic sensor is that since you need an emitter and a receiver, it actually looks like it looks like two eyes, you know.
Mm.
So you have that on a servo, which means you can determine, you can aim that thing to look different directions without turning the robot at all. And then, of course, you know which direction that is. So then you can rotate the robot in the direction it was interested in. And maybe you can have it go into a hallway. I mean, how does it work?
Indeed. Well, in fact, the book, first of all, describes how to use the distance sensor fixed. And the way the robot explores its environment there is that when it detects an object, it stops, and then it rotates itself, looks one direction. So it rotates left, say, sees whether it's clear to the left. If it's not, it will then rotate to the right. And if it's clear to the right, it will then move to the right. If it's not clear, either to the left or the right, then it will turn around.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of works, but the problem is that the rotations of the robot introduce kind of small amount of errors. So although the robot can avoid obstacles, it's actually much more accurate if when the robot stops, instead of it rotating itself, it simply looks around, and the servos are very, very accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So it can take a very accurate picture of where the objects are, and then make a decision to move off if it's a clear space or to turn around and look somewhere else if, in fact, it's in a blind alley.
Now, the robot that Wyatt was talking about earlier that he built, it looks like it would be on a table or an area, and if it had a red ball, it would hit it, and if it had a blue ball, it didn't hit it. What kind of sensor is that?
A color sensor, probably.
Are those expensive?
Say again?
Are those expensive?
No. In fact, one of the reasons why this whole area of technology has become so popular is, well, there are two reasons. One is that very easy to use and open source tools are available.
Mm-hmm.
But the huge numbers of smartphones and game devices that are built has resulted in all kinds of sensors being manufactured in such volumes that they are relatively inexpensive.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing that's really kind of amazing. I mean, you go into a toy store right now, and a base-level toy that seems like an appropriate gift to give is about $30, $35, something like that. That kind of money we're talking about for, you know, the Arduino off its bat. And you can, of course, do fun things with it right off the bat. And so if you're... I wanted to do the show with you to make sure that it was set up in time for people to go shopping because there's a lot of shopping going on right now. And one of the things that happens every year is I'll get people contact me saying, what's a good geek gift? What's a good geeky gift to give? And I'm always going, well, right off the bat, Legos is amazing. That's why we had Wyatt talk about these Lego books. You know what? Any geek likes Legos. I haven't met any people that are geeks that don't like Legos. So right off the bat, that's an awesome toy at any age. I'd love to get a Lego kit. I'd probably do it with my son. I'd probably give it to my kids. But you know, I play Legos with them all the time. And the other thing to do is start just playing with electronics. I mean, I think a lot of geeks have had those early electronic kits when they grew up. They could make a radio. Wyatt's got one that's called Wyatt, what's that computer thing that you, the electronics kit, you go snap something? Do you know what it's called? The one that you can do like experiments in electronics. You make radios and things. I can't recall what it's called.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, we'll put it up on the website.
Oh, Scratch?
No, well, that's the programming environment. No, I'm talking about the physical electronics. In any case, that kind of space where you enable creativity in technology, highly recommended as a learning experience and as an engagement experience. And I definitely recommend Michael's book, Make an Arduino-Controlled Robot. Michael, thank you so much for being on. Did you have one closing thing you want to say before we ran out of time today?
Just I hope that people begin to, if you haven't looked at this kind of technology, please do have a look at it. It's great fun.
Yeah, and you can. He got some great links to his book, and from his book, The Kits, there's a whole world out there in making electronics and robotics. You don't really have to have a soldering iron, you know, at this point. You can plug them all in together and play in that space. And again, I just want to recommend to people, if you're buying a geek gift, don't buy them a... It's very hard to do if you're trying to get them a phone or something like that, because the geek already knows exactly what they want. They've probably already gotten it. So unless you're getting feedback from them, it's hard to get that. But something that explores technology, something that's a learning space, that I think is always enjoyable. So it's always something that's a good thing to get. Michael Margolis, thank you so much for joining us from London. The book is Make an Arduino-Controlled Robot, and I hope to see you online and your next book as well. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Take care. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Celebrating 40 years together, this is 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz, streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks today with Michael Moragas and Wyatt Troxell. Thank you for joining me, and go visit us online at geekspeak.org.